It is a privilege to be here today, passing on to you not only the teachings of my great teacher, Shunyu Suzuki Roshi, but by passing on the meaning of his teaching, giving meaning to the practice of all of the great Buddhist ancestors, all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha. The 12 links of afflictive emotions, contaminated actions, and suffering represent our basic situation. And the Dalai Lama's question, can the mind be separated from such ignorance or not? That's the question that's being addressed today. And here is his thinking. He says that any kind of consciousness can be subjected to conditioning, but no matter how mistaken a consciousness is, it can increase due to conditioning or familiarization. Even so, it cannot be limitlessly increased because it's based on a false premise. But on the other hand, a consciousness with a valid foundation, even though it might not presently be very powerful, given that we're not used to thinking in this way, still it can always be strengthened. And since it's validly founded, the sky's the limit. It's infinite. It has infinite potential. So does this make sense? He's saying if we set our mind going on a correct basis, even though it's weak, we can always strengthen it. But and it has no limits because it's founded on a correct basis. So, and furthermore, he says that so long as one keeps practicing, one's mental qualities do not require the renewal of the exertion involved in first acquiring them. So therefore, their strength can be increased. In other words, once a mental quality is in the mind with a certain force, you don't keep having to exert that force again and again to bring that level. So therefore, additional training will increase that quality. So that's good news. Since the root of suffering is ignorance, suffering stems from an untamed mind. And correspondingly, relief from suffering comes from purifying and destroying the ignorance that's in the mind, that is, taming the mind. And a mind is tamed by mental training. And the Dalai Lama explains that by saying, basically, we're training in nonviolence. And with this type of training, one gradually comes to see that it is indeed possible to transform consciousness. And this is a totally, he just lays this out so clearly. There's four levels. So the first level in training in nonviolence is the practice of the first level is to restrain oneself from engaging in activities that harm others. That's level one. The second is to implement antidotes to the afflictive emotions that drive the bad actions in the first place, anger, hate, jealousy, and pride, for example. And the third level is to overcome even the predispositions previously established by afflictive emotions. So reflecting on how the unwanted faults of cyclic existence stem from ignorance, one concludes, this is the Dalai Lama thinking here, one concludes that one must practice these three levels of nonviolence, first restraining the bad activities of afflictive emotions, second, restraining the afflictive emotions themselves, and third, restraining the predispositions established by the afflictive emotions. To remove latent predispositions, we have to first extinguish the afflictive emotions, because otherwise there's no possibility of removing the predispositions. The state of having entirely removed afflictive emotions as well as their predispositions is called Buddhahood. Whereas the mere removal of the afflictive emotions is called being an arhat. You've probably heard of that, being an arhat. So Buddhas and arhats are fundamentally, they have different levels of attainment. I had always thought that arhats are different from Buddhas in that they were out for just for their own individual benefit, whereas Buddhas are out for benefiting all beings. But actually, they have a different level of attainment also. A Buddha has removed afflictive emotions as well as the predispositions to afflictive emotions. So they kind of like wipe the slate clean. The Dalai Lama says that the destruction of afflictive emotions and the predispositions established by them is like an offensive engagement. So it's important to first engage in a defensive line of action to make sure that one won't come under the influence of counterproductive emotions later. So this is why it's important initially to restrain ill deeds of body and speech. The final aim is the removal of all afflictive emotions together with their predispositions, and that's the attainment of Buddhahood. But in implementing the means for bringing this about, one must initially restrain bad activities of the afflictive emotions, which is harming others. When one acts selfishly or commits wrong actions, one not only harms others, but also ultimately brings suffering on yourself. So thus, without even considering what violence does to others, considering only what violence inflicted on oneself in terms of the cause and effect of actions leading into cyclic existence, one can see that it's necessary to restrain ill deeds of body and speech. So he's saying, the Dalai Lama is saying, don't even think about how this is good for other people. This is also good for you. That all of us benefit from restraining ourselves from bad actions, basically harming others, being harmful to others. At this level of the teaching, there's no reference to love or compassion for other people. Rather, the emphasis is on realizing that ill deeds are detrimental even from the point of view of one's own welfare. So this is the first level of reflection of the faults of violence and the need to restrain ill deeds of body and speech. But even so, there's no guarantee we won't come under their influence next time around, next lifetime. Therefore, the best defense is to practice the next level of nonviolence, which can be called restraining the afflictive emotions themselves. These are what is mentioned in the 12, these afflictive emotions are all mentioned in the 12 links. The root is ignorance that conceives of objects as inherently existing. And the force of this ignorance induces desire and hatred or anger, as well as many other types of afflictive emotions, such as pride and doubt and enmity and jealousy and so forth. So the Dalai Lama says, let us consider our enemy, whom we hate with a strong feeling. Due to the fact that this person's mind is untamed, he or she engages in activities that bring injury to us. If this anger or wish to harm were the very nature of the person, then it would not be able to be altered in any way. But this is not the case, that hatred subsides in the nature of that person. Rather, just like ourselves, the person displays bad behavior due to the influence of generating afflictive emotions. So we ourselves, this is, I love that the Dalai Lama is saying this, we ourselves engage in bad behavior, do we not? And I'm thinking, well, you know, he did sneak cookies out of the pantry when he was six. I guess, you know, that's a bad behavior, I guess. It's so odd to think of him using himself as an example for, and we all engage in bad behavior, don't we? Still, we do not always think that we are completely bad. The situation is the same with this other person whom we consider to be an enemy. Consequently, the actual troublemaker is not the person, but his afflictive emotion. The real enemy is an internal factor. So as practitioners, our real battle takes place inside of ourselves. And it will take time, but this is the only way to minimize counterproductive human qualities. But through such practice, we'll attain more mental peace, not only in the distant future, but day to day. And so at this point, one is training to overcome the afflictive emotions. And to do this, it's necessary to destroy their root, which is ignorance that conceives inherent existence. To do this, it is necessary to generate a reasoning consciousness that perceives objects in exactly the opposite way as we would perceive them with ignorance. Only such a consciousness can serve as an antidote to afflictive emotions. However, in order to develop a realization of emptiness, capable of removing this ignorance, we cannot merely generate a reasoned inferential consciousness that realizes emptiness. It's not, we can use our thoughts to imagine just the opposite of what we normally think, but that's not enough, actually. We need to have the actual experience of emptiness ourselves. So this third level, the first level is getting rid of bad behavior caused by afflictive emotions. The second level is getting rid of the afflictive emotions. Getting rid of is not the best expression. It's letting go of, let's say. And then the third level is letting go of our predispositions to afflictive emotions, that the predispositions that they've laid down. And that has two pathways. One is intellectual and one is fully experiencing. So one is the intellectual view of emptiness and the other is experiencing emptiness itself, which is done through meditation. And for us, Zazen. So He talks about generating, developing samadhi or meditative stabilization, which is a union of calm, abiding, and special insight. And that it is said that in order to generate this wisdom consciousness, we first have to generate the calm abiding of mind. And it's advantageous to develop the mind's ability to remain on its object of observation in an alert and clear manner by developing this a one-pointedness of mind. This is a separate practice from Zazen, but a lot of people who practice Zazen also develop this kind of one-pointedness of mind that that the Dalai Lama talks about. But I don't want to emphasize it too much because it's not really our practice. I think we can use Zazen for everything we need. So in order to reach the point where even internal subtle distractions have been pacified and the mind remains continuously on the subject of its observation, on the object of its observation, one must restrain grosser distractions, like ill deeds that scatter the mind. And for this, one needs training in ethics. Initially, one trains in ethics, which forms the basis for later practice. Then, through the practice of meditative stabilization, the mind becomes very focused and effective in meditating on emptiness. So again, first there's like the view of emptiness. It's a kind of intellectually acquired understanding. And then later, it's emptiness itself, which we experience in our practice of Zazen. This wisdom that realizes emptiness directly undermines the ignorance that conceives of inherent existence. And the extinguishing of that ignorance is the sphere of reality that we call liberation. So when he says Buddhahood, it's the same thing. So, in order to answer the question, can the mind be separated from such ignorance or not? The Dalai Lama has laid out this four-step program. So basically, this is to kind of just review. Basically, we're training in nonviolence. And with this type of training, we gradually come to see that it is possible to transform consciousness. The first level in the practice of nonviolence is to restrain oneself from activities that harm others. The second level is to implement antidotes to afflictive emotions that drive the bad actions. The third is to overcome even the predispositions previously established by afflictive emotions, and intellectually acquired obstructions are overcome first. And then gradually in the fourth level, innate obstructions are removed. So, with innate obstructions, there are many different levels of afflictive emotions to be overcome, but finally, one completely extricates the ignorance that is the root of all the afflictive emotions, the conception of inherent existence, and that's called liberation. These conceptual elaborations are ceased through cultivating the view that realizes emptiness. But because that into which they're extinguished is the reality of emptiness itself, here emptiness is also interpreted as that into which the fictive elaborations of inherent existence cease. So that reality, the emptiness into which all of the afflictive emotions have been extinguished through wisdom, that's the true cessation of the source of suffering, which is ignorance. So really, wisdom is the true cessation of ignorance. It makes sense. Then the Dalai Lama opens the discussion up for questions. And there were some really interesting ones that aren't exactly on this topic, but I thought they would interest you. So I'm going to share them with you. The first one is someone asks, this is to the Dalai Lama, can you speak about drowsiness in meditation? And he says, during meditation, the mind can come under the influence of lethargy, a heaviness of mind and body that leads to drowsiness or even sleep. This is due to the fact that the mode of apprehension of the mind has become too loose. A counteractive technique is to make the mind more taut, whereby it is revitalized. If this does not work, then one should imagine something bright or pay attention to the details of the object being meditated upon, since lethargy is caused by the mind's being withdrawn too much inside. If this too does not work, one can leave the session and look far into the distance, perhaps at a panoramic view, or wash one's face, or go outside into the fresh air. That was interesting to me that he says that if we get sleepy during meditation, we need to make our mind more taut, that our mind has become too loose or too weak. Another question is, we're told that progress along the spiritual path depends on faith. What is the substantial cause of faith? And then he has a two-part answer. He says, in general, faith is of three types: faith of clear delight, the faith of wishing to achieve a beneficial quality, and the faith of conviction. Concerning the main causes of faith, it's helpful to reflect on reasons that promote conviction, and beyond that, to develop actual experience yourself. As you think more and more upon reason, your ascertainment increases, and this in turn induces experience, whereby faith becomes more firm. But then he says, within faith, there's basically two types. One comes by adventitious causes, like suddenly sweeping over one, and another comes by exerting effort over a long period of time. And he says the latter is more stable, but adventitious experiences are nevertheless beneficial. It's helpful when you have a sudden, unusual, and profound experience to take hold of and sustain it with effort at the right time. I've talked with people who have had adventitious experiences, you know, just something will happen and it's just a very profound experience and they'll never forget it. And it's just very influential for the rest of their spiritual practice. The best one, I think, is this question. How can good Buddhists who are committed to not killing happily enjoy the results of murder by eating meat, fowl, and fish? And the Dalai Lama answers, in general, in Buddhist scriptures on discipline, the eating of meat is not prohibited. Also, monks and nuns are persons who, in a sense, are mendicants, going out and begging for food, and thus do not, when begging, state a preference, such as I would like such and such a kind of food. And he says, more than 15 years ago, I, the Dalai Lama, discussed this matter with a Sri Lankan monk who said that, strictly speaking, Buddhist monks and nuns are, therefore, neither necessarily vegetarian nor non-vegetarian. In the Bodhisattva vehicle, the general emphasis is on being vegetarian. Not eating meat is mostly considered preferable, and indeed, he says, some Japanese Buddhist communities are strictly vegetarian. I think that's true of San Francisco Zen Center and Green Gulch. And then the Dalai Lama says, I think this is the proper practice. But then in the Tantra vehicle, the three lower Tantra sets, action, performance, and yoga, prohibit meat eating. But in the highest yoga Tantra, there is no prohibition against eating meat. Then he says, still the best way is to be vegetarian. I myself, the Dalai Lama, tried in 1965 to become a vegetarian and remained so for 22 or 23 months. Then I contracted severe jaundice and was advised by my physician to discontinue vegetarianism. For those people who can follow strict vegetarianism, that is best. I thought that was a really interesting answer, that fundamentally, Buddhist monks and nuns, they're basically beggars. And when you beg, you can't ask for what you want. So this idea of being relying on other, on the generosity of others, is really fundamental. I thought that was really interesting. And that fundamentally Buddhism isn't about being vegetarian. I'm so used to it that I forgot that it's not really the Buddhist way necessarily. So, okay, here are five of the most important points. First, once a mental quality is in the mind with a certain force, one does not have to exert that degree of force again to bring it to that level. Hence, additional training will increase that quality. Secondly, reflecting on how the unwanted faults of cyclic existence stem from ignorance, one concludes that one must practice three levels of nonviolence. First, restraining the bad activities of the afflictive emotions, then restraining the afflictive emotions themselves, and finally, restraining the predispositions established by afflictive emotions. Third, when one acts selfishly or commits wrong actions, one not only harms others, but also ultimately brings suffering on oneself. Fourth, the afflictive emotions that bring about all this trouble for us are those mentioned in the 12 links of dependent arising. The root is the ignorance that conceives objects as inherently existing. the force of this ignorance induced desire and hatred, as well as many other types of afflictive emotions, such as pride, doubt, enmity, and jealousy. And lastly, fifth, ignorance conceives phenomena to exist in and of themselves, whereas in fact objects do not exist that way. To overcome this ignorance, it is necessary first to refute with reasoning its conceived object inherent existence. So the first thing we do is we use reasoning to refute inherent existence. This is done through cultivating the view that realizes emptiness, because that into which they are extinguished is the reality of emptiness itself. Here, emptiness is also interpreted as that into which the fictive elaborations of the conception of inherent existence cease. That reality, the emptiness into which all of the afflictive emotions have been extinguished through the antidote of wisdom, is the true cessation of the sources of suffering, which is liberation. So here is a plan for your reflection during the week. For overcoming ignorance, the Dalai Lama has laid out a four-step program, which he introduces by explaining that basically we're training in nonviolence. And with this type of training, one gradually comes to see that it is indeed possible to transform consciousness. The first level in the practice of nonviolence is to restrain oneself from engaging in activities that harm others. The second level in the practice of nonviolence is to implement antidotes to the afflictive emotions that drive bad actions. The third level is to overcome even the predispositions previously established by the afflictive emotions, which is done initially by directly focusing on eradicating intellectually acquired obstructions. And then fourthly, the innate obstructions are removed. So first the intellectual obstructions and then the innate obstructions. That reality, the emptiness into which all of the afflictive emotions have been extinguished through the antidote of wisdom, is the true cessation of the sources of suffering, which is liberation. Liberation from ignorance, really. So regarding your assignment, for level one, please examine your behavior and determine if there remains any part that may be harmful to others. Identify that part and do something to stop or lessen it. For level two, please pick out one afflictive emotion that especially bothers you and implement antidotes to this particular emotion. This is about raising your consciousness. So, for example, if pride is the emotion you decide to focus on, then figure out what will in you prevent prideful actions or prideful feelings. For level three, identify at least one intellectual obstruction to realizing our lack of inherent individual existence and find a way to soften it. So think of one intellectual obstruction and find a way to soften it. And for level four, we want to increase our practice of Zazen by some amount and our quality. And then the end of this is, for those of you who have been practicing Zazen on your own and perhaps not feeling the kind of progress the Dalai Lama is speaking of, it would be good for you to find an online Zazen group so that your practice is, first, with other people, and second, more regular in both time and frequency. It would be good to practice one period a day, formally with other people. And thanks to COVID, you can do this from your homes. So please choose from the many options one group session that works for your schedule and start to practice this way for a while. It will mean organizing your day around your time for Zazen, rather than sticking it in here and there, like an unwanted cousin. Well, I wonder if there are any questions.
Yes, Gail. So the first question that we have is, let's say I engage in discussion with another person and we offend each other via our words, which culminates in angry emotions on both sides. Is that considered harming another? How do I discern between standing up for myself without hurting back?
The short answer is yes, actually. Yes, it is considering harming others because of the anger involved. Anger is one of the big three, greed, hate, and delusion. So hate and anger are considered the same thing, or close enough. But the real answer to your question is, you don't need to arouse anger or raise your voice or anything like that, showing signs of anger in order to disagree with somebody. You can just be you can be calm and quiet and say everything that you need to say without raising your voice. In fact, probably making a more persuasive case for whatever your point of view is. And anger is really extra. It's unnecessary and it's extra. And you can practice ways that work for your own self to do what I just said, speak your mind without anger, speak your mind with logic and with compassion for the other person, and even compassion for the point of view of the other person. And you could even say that in your argument. I understand what you're saying, et cetera, but I'm not sure you understand what I'm saying, which is da, da, da. I think that's all. Basically, you can practice it's called lovely speech. Lovely speech is using your words appropriately without anger to make points that you feel are worth making. I hope that answers your question. Thank you.
Thank you, Gail. The next question that we have is, you've gone over this before, but can you give some examples of how we can go about taming our minds?
So anything that involves training will tame your mind. And training means focusing on something outside of you, which is why spiritual practice can feel so boring to people, because it's something outside of you, especially chanting, you know, you're focused outside of you. So that's a form of training. So for example, school is a form of training. Holding down a job is a form of training. Living in a conscientious community is a form of training, because you have to be considerate of others. Military service even is a form of training, as well as any other kind of service is usually a form of training. You also can turn things into a form of training. Like, for example, if you want to learn a language, you can turn it into, I want to learn Mandarin. I'm going to practice studying Mandarin an hour a day, no matter what. And it's the no matter what part that's really important, that you learn how to hold a priority of your own, not a priority of your boss or your teacher, but a priority of your own. I want to learn Mandarin above everything else. And then you learn how to say no, and you learn how to hold your own higher purpose and actually accomplish anything that you decide to accomplish. You can also, you who are parents can also show your children how to have practices like setting the table or doing their homework. The sooner kids learn how to have a practice, I think this is one of the biggest benefits of after-school sports, because they have to go to soccer practice or they have to go to basketball practice. And that's a practice, and they have to do that or else they'll be kicked off the team. So they're learning to have a practice, and a practice is the answer to almost everything, because you turn it into something that's not really about you. It's about the practice. And then you do that thing, and then you learn to accomplish what you want. including taming your mind. I hope that makes sense. So taming your mind is about training your mind, and training your mind is about focusing it on something outside of yourself. Okay, thank you.
So the next question that we have is, today, for the first time, when you were saying that thing about Buddhists basically being neither vegetarian nor non-vegetarian, I got that for a Buddhist, impartiality would be the higher virtue. Is that correct?
That was great that you got that. Yes, it's correct. Starting now that we're on the 12 links, and starting with contact, I think that's the fourth link. That's the moment when we start making discriminations, like pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. So as soon as we start getting into that territory of preferences, or they're called discriminations, we discriminate, this is pleasant, this is unpleasant. That's when the kind of ball really gets rolling toward cyclic existence. Because it goes from contact to feeling, attachment, grasping, another birth, old age and death. It just goes right along. So food is a primary arena for discriminations, and this idea that a Buddhist monk is primarily a mendicant, it means that they're primarily impartial. You can't be a beggar and have preferences. So you hold out your bowl, and then whatever is put in it, that's what you eat. And if nothing's put in it, you don't eat that day. That's how monks usually operate. So you have to be impartial, and impartiality in a way is a higher virtue, in the sense that we need to kill in order to survive. I mean, the bitter truth is, in order to survive, we have to kill something. If we don't kill a cow, we're going to kill a carrot. You know, we have to kill something. And the best we can do, really, is exchange, I'm going to put this correctly, we trade out our good behavior, you know, something virtuous that we've decided to do with our energy that we've gotten from eating. So we take this either animal or vegetable's sacrifice of its life to us and turn it into this virtuous behavior. I think that's as good as it gets. That's prioritizing impartiality over being a vegetarian or non-vegetarian. It's not obvious. It's not the obvious. I used to think that being a Buddhist and being vegetarian were the same thing. But when you really think about it, the Buddha's monks went out and begged every single day. And then they had one meal a day before noon, and then they washed their bowl, and then that was it till the next day before noon. There was a lot about impartiality and needing to just accept except what people were given. And they also had all these rules about, we don't choose what neighborhood we go into. We go into different neighborhoods every day, and whatever we're given, that's what we get. So we don't just go to rich neighborhoods, for example. I think that's all I have to say on that subject. But impartiality is a really important point, especially in this discourse that we're in now on the 12 Nidanas. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Gail. The last question that we have is, do you know of places that do online Zazen daily? I'd appreciate some guidelines about where to start looking.
Yes, I do. Only two of the, I know five. And there could be more. These are just what I've come across. But the two most obvious are in our same time zone. So one is Sonoma Mountain Monastery. So that's in Sonoma, and it's in the same time zone. And Zen Center, San Francisco Zen Center. Those two monasteries basically offer multiple daily Zazen practices. And really, I think all through the day. Maybe not. I'm not sure about that. They might not be in the afternoon so much. Then there's Zen Mountain Monastery, which is on the East Coast. So that would be 3 hours earlier. No, later. I think 3 hours later. And then Sanshin Zen Community, which is Okamura Roshi's Zen community, and that's in Bloomington, Indiana. And then there's another one, Great Tree Zen Women's Temple. Great Tree Zen Women's Temple. And that's in North Carolina. And they also offer online Zazen. And that would be maybe, I'm not sure, it's either 2 or 3 hours difference. I'm sure there are others too. For example, the Minnesota Zen Center probably also offers online Zazen. So that would be the Minneapolis, Minnesota Zen Center. That's all I can think of right off the top. But this idea of you practicing with a group on a daily basis, I think would help a lot with the regularity of your Zazen and also the quality of your Zazen, because everything is introduced with proper bells, and there's a beginning and an ending that everyone abides by the same time. Some of these might have different time lengths. Some of them might be 30-minute periods and some might be 40-minute periods. I don't know so much about that. But I do know that it would be really beneficial for everyone to practice once a day with other people. And it saves you a lot of time to not have to drive somewhere and back. Okay, thank you.
There is another question which just came in. The question is it possible or useful to try to practice impartiality? Or is forming opinions on things inevitable until ignorance is removed? Another way to ask this is if inauthentic impartiality is actually helpful.
I'm going to say yes, that inauthentic impartiality is helpful. It's the same as smiling. You know, Paramahansa Yogananda used to say, you know, be a smile millionaire or something like that. The idea being, have a smile on your face, even if you don't feel it, because eventually, if you do that enough, you will start feeling it. So you can, another way to say this is fake it till you make it. You've heard that expression. Impartiality is really important, as you can see from these 12 links. It's critical. It's, you know, every time we start down a path that's not impartial, we're creating another lifetime, another suffering lifetime, constantly with our preferences. So it's really important that we stop that, that we stop our partiality behaviors. So I think it's fine if all you can do is pretend like you're impartial, then that's a good way to start. Pretend like you're impartial. And I think that you're more likely to establish impartiality from there than if you never thought about it at all. Okay, I hope that answers that question. I think we're saved by the bell anyway. I want to thank my team, Sahar and Brian and Brendan, and also you for coming so regularly and faithfully each week. I so appreciate that. And also the people who come during the week to attend, who can't attend on Sunday. Thank you so much. And we have two more meetings in this series. I'll see you next week. Bye-bye.